This is The Guardian.
Hi, Laura Murphy Oates here. Today we're playing an episode about the island nation of Barbados becoming a republic, made by our global news podcast, Today in Focus. I think this episode will really appeal to anyone who's been tuning into the global reckonings happening around race, slavery, and the legacy of colonization. And it tackles the really thorny question of what Britain owes to the people of its former colonies whose ancestors were enslaved. Here's Michael Safi, one of the hosts of Today in Focus, reporting from Barbados.
The first British monarch to claim Barbados was James I. At midnight last night, local time, Elizabeth II became the last. From today, Barbados has a president, Sandra Mason, and some hope and opportunity to move forward on a journey that started with the emancipation of enslaved people nearly 200 years ago, but isn't over. I'm in Bridgetown to try to understand what this moment means for the future of Barbados. And people keep telling me, to get what's coming next, you need to look back. From The Guardian, I'm Michael Safi. Today in Focus, Barbados becomes a republic and Britain faces a reckoning. Before we start, just a heads up. Today's episode includes descriptions of torture and other violence. About a half hour's drive from Bridgetown, the capital of Barbados, is the most shockingly green landscape. There's vegetation everywhere, palm trees, fruit, rich soil, the sounds of birds and crickets. This is where Esther Phillips, the country's poet laureate, grew up.
This was a place where I remember very well my grandmother had planted up this land because we lived off the land. Everything you could think of, well, pumpkin, Christophine, beans, carrots, beets. It was a childhood that where there was a lot of freedom to run and all the fresh air and the fresh fruits, looking down plums and guavas, you know.
Esther's family home was right next to this place called the Drax Hall Estate, a sugarcane plantation. It's been there 400 years and it's still producing sugar today. Her grandfather worked there in the 50s, drawing canes, and their home was surrounded by the estate on the east, south, and west. Esther can remember, as a kid, catching glimpses of the people working there and the people running it.
Sometimes in walking home from school, we would find ourselves walking through Drax Hall Yard. So, of course, we saw the plantation house. Sometimes just got a glimpse of these little white children. Then sometimes, of course, it was the overseer that we were all scared of and tried our best to run from. But we did not know why. We knew that this place represented something that was alien to us or was not friendly. What we did not know was the history. We had no idea. I am still processing how it is possible that I grew up all these years not knowing the horror that existed some hundred years ago, not far away from here. Placid and tranquil as this is, right now, under these same lands, you have thousands of slaves who were worked to death.
Now the road with the girl walking?
Yeah.
It's this one here.
Esther shows me just up the road to Drax Hall, the plantation house, surrounded on all sides by cane fields.
I see. So this is the entry to Drax Hall.
That's right. We want to take you somewhere where you can see them.
and they've put up a couple of barrels with "Sorry, we're closed" and "Private property" on it. In the lead up to the Republic, roads leading to the estate have been closed off. And that wasn't there before. Before, you could just walk right in.
No, it was not. So
but Esther knows another way.
Oh, this is junk soil land here. All of this. All this that you can see.
As far as the eye can see.
Yep. Yeah. This is a... So there is the house. That's the house up there. What we're seeing ahead of us is Jack Soil Plantation House, a Jacobean manor. If you were closer, you could see the various gables and components, if you want, of that kind of style. This is what I call, indeed, a witness in stone, because that stone that was cut there, carved stone, that was actually cut by the enslaved at the time. And you could imagine the back-breaking toil that it took to build that place, for which, of course, they've got no credit. And that is the symbol, actually, of the oppression, of the brutality, of the crime against humanity that was committed against my ancestors.
The plantation was established by James Drax, who arrived with his brother William in the 1620s.
They came over from England. They were very poor people, but there are people who decided to come to Barbados to make their fortune, and that's exactly what they did. And it was the largest plantation in Barbados. Clearly would have needed more manpower than most others. And he was also reputed to be among the cruelest of slave owners.
We're still learning about what life was like for enslaved people on the Drax estate. Historians have only recently started studying it. People like Sir Hilary Beckles, a Barbadian, who's written about what happened when the Draxes learned of an impending uprising by the Africans working on the plantation. 120 of the leaders were rounded up, he says. 47 were burned alive. 30 men were castrated and left to bleed to death. Barbados then has been called the world's first slave society. At one stage, 80% of the population of the island were enslaved. Keeping them in line and working required unimaginable brutality.
Whippings, the torture, the hangings, the whipping block, all these things, as well, of course, as the raping of the women and sometimes children. I mean, it didn't seem as though there was any savagery that these people did not carry out.
It was eerie standing in fields that were so peaceful, looking up at this magnificent house and imagining this is one of the places where historians believe the plantation model of slavery, the one that spread and took root in the US and across the Americas, was pioneered and perfected. That's because the Drax family were innovators. Beckles, the historian, says they invented a new business model. Instead of transporting African men and women and working them to death, which took about 7 years, he treated the women a little better, kept them healthy enough to have children.
One of the ways to get more slaves, of course, was to let the slaves breed. Yeah. So you encourage them to keep breeding and breeding and breeding. That way you didn't have to buy them. You just had them. You had as many as you wanted.
The history of this place is the history of British rule on Barbados. There were plantations like this all over the island. Cane fields and the model of slavery that made them grow soon spread to Jamaica and across the hemisphere. It made sugar cheap for the first time in European history and made the UK extraordinarily rich. But the cruelty of the model, the estimated 3.1 million Africans that Britain alone condemned to slavery, couldn't be ignored forever. In the 1830s, after more than 200 years, Britain abolished slavery. They paid millions of pounds in compensation to the owners of enslaved people. The Africans transported over and their descendants got nothing. For For a century after, many kept working on those same plantations for low pay. Esther says her own grandfather worked on the Drax estate for a shilling a week, a pittance. It's strange to imagine that Queen Elizabeth was on the throne by then. It's also strange that, given how crucial this slavery was to both British and Barbadian history, it's easy to visit the island and never hear a word of it. There's just one statue in Bridgetown dedicated to emancipation at the centre of a busy roundabout. Esther talks about this great silence.
I think of actually playing and walking on the bones, practically, of people who were my ancestors, I mean, and who were lying there. But there was almost like a kind of an indifference, a kind of a silence. I have started to explore the reason for the silence. I asked two leading historians in Barbados their thoughts about it. They're convinced it had to do with shame and guilt. Who wants to revisit that kind of trauma? Wants to get out of it, or the appearance of getting out?
Tell me about that silence. What does that mean for someone who doesn't know Barbados?
What the silence means is that people can have a stereotypical idea of Barbados, sun and sea, and some even have this notion of frolicking natives and people sitting under coconut trees drinking coconut water and rum. We depend so heavily on tourism, okay? We know what the tourist market is. Britain is one of our biggest tourist markets, all right? Do you want to offend them? Do you want to talk too much about this past slavery, which might cause people to feel disturbed and bothered? Or are you going to continue to cover it up and pretend it never existed or that it doesn't matter anymore? Now, that silence, I think, is wrong. It's wrong because even though it is buried, even though that the truth is buried to some extent, in very many ways it is not, because what is showing up is that the past is still with us.
It's woven into the very fabric of our life, all aspects of our life. You can't enslave, loot, and plunder a people for multiple generations over hundreds of years and expect that that will not have an imprint on the present.
David Commerchong is an activist and diplomat. He's been campaigning for a republic all his life. Part of what he works on is assessing the ongoing impact of slavery, the way it still echoes hundreds of years later.
Health is a very, very clear area because the Caribbean populations have the highest incidence of chronic non-communicable diseases. The experts tell us that we can trace this factor right back to those centuries of compressed terror and tension on the plantations of the Caribbean, which in fact were the world's first concentration camps. You're talking about people who lived, whose daily experience was the experience of living in a concentration camp over hundreds of years. That's what we're talking about. So not only the stress and the tension, but also the very deficient diets that they were subjected to. And so that has resulted in a present-day population that is uniquely vulnerable to diseases like diabetes and hypertension.
Barbados should be a wealthy country. Over the centuries, it's produced a lot and exported a lot, but that money was used to build another country.
You go to Britain, you go to London, and you see those fantastic buildings and that fantastic, that massive infrastructure. Where did that come from? Ultimately, that came from the looting and plundering of colonies like Barbados.
Today, the Caribbean has a debt problem. David says it's because when the countries of the region became independent, their leaders found they were building nations virtually from scratch.
The Caribbean is one of the most highly indebted regions in the world. That money hasn't gone into building armies or fighting wars. Those loans have gone into building infrastructure, building roads, building airports, building schools, building polyclinics, you know, expanding the public service and so forth. But it has come at a cost.
You can measure the legacy of colonialism in concrete things like money or people's health, but it's also symbolic, carried around in people's minds. And it's that mental impact that's part of what's driving Barbados to become a republic.
Part of it is symbolism, but symbolism is important because for the past 55 years, we have been laboring under the symbolism of having Queen Elizabeth II, this English woman born in England, with her first loyalty being to the nation and people of England. We have symbolically, we have had her as our head of state, as the person who embodies our unity and our legitimacy as a nation and a people. I mean, that's just slightly ridiculous. How can the Queen of England, born in England, living thousands of miles away from us, not connected to our culture, our history, and our mores, how can she embody the struggle of the African people of Barbados against enslavement and exploitation and their struggle for dignity? It's not possible.
The British knew symbols were important. Bridgetown, the capital, is still full of them, and they're impressive. The Parliament building, the third oldest anywhere in the world, is like a huge Gothic cathedral, one of the tallest buildings in the city. In the 60s, the Union Jack came down from over it, replaced with the new Barbados flag.
Your Royal Highness, this is a very proud moment in the history of the people of Barbados. I am glad, as I am sure, that the members of my government are equally glad that we were born at a time when we could see this eventful day.
The country was independent, but found it wasn't entirely free to decide its destiny. The idea of cutting ties with the Queen has been around since the beginning. But people worried about how Britain would react, and they had other priorities, like building a new country. It wasn't until the 1990s that a government commission finally said, "It's time, let's do this." Even then, it would still take more than 20 years for Barbados to make the leap. There's a statue here that kind of tells the story. More than 200 years ago, before there was even one in London, Bridgetown unveiled a bronze statue of Admiral Horatio Nelson, the British naval hero who defeated the French at the Battle of Trafalgar. Alexander Downes, who grew up in the city, used to pass by the statue in what was then called Trafalgar Square all the time.
So you'd ask the question, oh, like, what is this? And you're just like, oh, that's the Lord Nelson statue. And it wasn't just what was said, it was how it was said. It's like, oh, that's the Lord Nelson statue. It's like, okay, so what is the Lord Nelson statue? Oh, Lord Admiral Nelson is this guy who saved Barbados from the French, and it's the Battle of Trafalgar. And you're like, oh, okay, that sounds pretty cool. You know, like, this guy saved Barbados. Awesome. He's a hero.
And that was what he believed, what everyone told him for years, until he went to university to study history and was lectured by people like Hilary Beckles, and began to ask questions.
And so I began to, like, do some digging on my own. And I didn't even have to do that much digging because there were so many, like, you know, calypsos written about it, like, songs written about it.
Well, he want burning, cause he in the use. He want pelting in the dumpers' garbage refuse. When at the meetings, I hear the quarreling, and I ask them who this man. I couldn't believe that they talking about Nelson, cause I didn't know that he caused so much trouble. I didn't know he brings so much pain to the people.
when your eyes start to open, you're like, whoa.
What he learned was that Nelson wasn't just the most celebrated defender of the British Empire that had enslaved so many Barbadians. He had actively opposed and repeatedly voted against efforts to abolish slavery in British colonies. And hundreds of years later, his statue still stood in the middle of the capital of a country, 90% of whom were descendants of those same enslaved people. Alex wasn't the first to realise this and to wonder, what the hell was that statue still doing there? From the 1980s onwards, there had been a fierce public debate about Nelson. Lots of people wanted him taken down, but many still worried it would cost too much or send the wrong message to Britain, where most of the tourists were still coming from, and where Nelson was still indisputably a hero. So the government came up with a compromise.
What they did was essentially to flip the direction the statue was facing.
Like, they literally spun Nelson around 180 degrees, so he no longer looked over Bridgetown's main thoroughfare.
We're not moving it, but we're moving it.
That probably seemed a bit unsatisfying, even back in 1989. But from the vantage point of now, in the eyes of a young generation of Barbadians with no memory of the colonial era and a growing understanding of what really happened on their island, it was absurd, unacceptable. It was like dry tinder waiting for a match. And then, in May 2020, an African-American, George Floyd, was murdered on camera in the streets of the city of Minneapolis.
You know, us seeing what's happening around the world, people are waking up, you know, supporting Black Lives Matter, the people in North America, you know, the protests all over the world, I understand it. And I said to myself, well, in Barbados, what are we doing? We have a colonial past. We have a past that's steeped in racism. What are we doing, you know? And I know, like, the statue, it literally is just a symbol of something greater. But my thought was, if we can start with this, it's just brick and mortar. If we can start with this, then we can get the ball rolling to start addressing some bigger issues.
So we started with his friends, taking their temperatures on it.
I literally said, what do you guys think about, like, the statue? You're like, they're like, oh, that statue needs to come down, you know, like. I was like, you'll feel like a movement to, like, get this thing. They were like, yeah, you know, you could try it. Like, you know, your friends support you. Your friends support you no matter what you say. So they were like, yeah, you know, sure, try it. I literally started this thing on Twitter. And I just tweeted, it's like, starting petition, this is why it's important. And I think I did that maybe like 6 p.m. the night. And, you know, I left it. I went and played some PlayStation, went to bed. And I woke up in the morning. It was like 1,000 signatures. My inbox is blowing up. So I'm like, oh, okay. This is a bit unexpected, you know, but this is cool. And then, you know, again, the media calling me and they're like, so what's the next step? I'm like, next step? I was like, okay, maybe I need to, like, actually, I didn't expect that level of support, you know, because I felt strongly about it, but I didn't know that everyone else did. And so, like, I sat down and I formulated, like, you know, I'm going to do this open letter to the Prime Minister when we get, if and when we get 10,000 signatures, and this is what I'm going to write, etc. And, you know, within the space of like a couple of weeks, we had got, you know, 10,000 signatures, send the letter to the PM, and that triggered a whole set of meetings. And it was in that time that I realized that I think Barbados has reached a point of social consciousness where things were ready to happen.
There was still some pushback. People who thought the past was just that, over, and had nothing to do with the future.
Why do you want to move this thing? It's been there for before you were even born. You know, have some respect for your history. I'm like, but, you know, 10 years from now, what I do today is going to be our history as well. It's like, so am I bound to eternity to accept what's always happened? Or can I shape my own future and in doing so shape, you know, history for people to reflect upon? And I think that's where my generation, that's how we think.
On November 16, 2020, Alex and the movement behind him won. After more than 200 years, Lord Nelson's statue came down.
Pick up Nelson. Pick up Nelson. Pick up Nelson. Put up a page on. Put up a page on.
There was a ceremony, music on the main stage, and dancing. While behind it, the statue, now on its back in a wooden cage, was lifted onto the bed of a truck and driven away. In her speech that day, the Prime Minister, Mia Motley, acknowledged that taking the statue down was symbolic, but that symbolism mattered.
This government has been very clear that national consciousness and identity come at the core of the nation state. And that if we do not know who we are, if we are not clear what we will fight for, then we are doomed.
What do you think it means that it succeeded now? What does it tell you about Barbados and about the mindset of especially young Barbadians?
I think we're ready for change.
The PM felt the same way. The day the statue came down, the government announced that in a year's time, Barbados was going to finally break free of the monarchy. It was going to become a republic with a president, a largely symbolic office, occupied by a Barbadian. Before I came here, I expected this would be a moment of national joy, parades, parties. But one thing that surprised me is that's not really the case. People are for this, overwhelmingly so. But it's like they still have more important things to worry about.
You're going to find certain sections that are head over heels, like me. I'm ready to, like, you know, do the most. And then you're going to find certain sections that are against it. Like, Pearson's like, why are we even changing? But then you're going to find many Barbadians who are just like, yeah, I guess it's cool, you know, like, we're going to wake up, you know, December 1st and nothing's really going to change. It's going to be the same country, you know? So it's really just of more of a symbolic gesture, which I think is really where people are. And so for people, their main focus is the tangibles. Like, you know, how will I eat tomorrow? Like, will I have a job tomorrow? Becoming a republic, if you put them on like a hierarchy of needs, it's probably not the number one thing we need. But I always tell people that doesn't mean it's not important. Like, more than one thing can be true at the same time. And like, sometimes I think that can be a very difficult concept for people to grasp, because it's not something that you can hold. It's not something you can see. It's something that's very philosophical. But years down the line, you see how these things then shape how you are as a people. So I think it's something like that, where in time, we'll see like how valuable it was. And I think the great thing about it is that it's not being set for us. We're setting it ourselves.
Coming up, what the present owes the past, and what many say the man who inherited the Drax estate owes Barbados.
Just have a sip of my lime squash.
This is Jonathan Smith in his natural habitat, a little restaurant on the beach in Bridgetown. A few years ago, Smith left a stressful life working in British investigative journalism for a sea change. He chucked it all in and followed his wife to Barbados. But he couldn't get away that easily. In 2020, an old journalist colleague gave him a ring.
Well, I was sort of, you know, just having a cold beer, swinging in my hammock, and
All right.
And the phone rang, and it was a chap called Paul Lashmar, who seemed to want to keep me busy and, you know, give me something to do.
Lashmar was working on a story for The Observer. Over the years, as more had been learned about the Drax plantation and its dark history, people had wondered, who owns it these days?
Paul wanted me to confirm who really owned it. So I just set about doing what I used to do, finding the documents. And as always, one person tells me to go to another place and that person tells me to go back to the place I've just come from. But eventually I found myself to the right offices, the Land Tax Department of the Revenue Authority here in Barbados. And after a number of visits, I was able to get hold of the document, which which of course is quite a, you know, quite a simple document really, but it's quite clear in what it says, you know, and at this stage I might have to take my sunglasses off and put my reading glasses.
Okay, it doesn't diminish the drama of this moment, though, let me assure you.
So what we have here, basically, I've got three documents, and one of those documents is the statement of account for Drax Hall Plantation, and it says the owner is Richard G, which stands for Grosvenor, Plunkett Earnley Earl Drax. And it's there in black and white.
Richard Grosvenor Plunkett Earnley Earl Drax, a Tory MP. In fact, one of the wealthiest people in the UK Parliament. Drax is outspoken, a hardline Brexiteer, anti-immigration.
We are full. That is the practicality of the situation we find ourselves in. And we have to do something about it. And I welcome the way the government is going. I hope we have a firm and fair system so that people who come into this country have visas, have references, have to put money into a bank account so that we can count them in and, if necessary, we can count them out.
And on at least one occasion, a critic of the conduct of Black Lives Matter protesters. He's a direct descendant of the Draxes that established that plantation, who perfected a model of slavery that made the family incredibly rich. Money they used to extend Charborough House, their Grade A-listed mansion, shielded from the outside world by the landmark Great Wall of Dorset that runs for about 3 miles. As a reminder of where some of that wealth came from, there's a road that bisects the estate. It's called Sugar Hill. And Drax's name is still on the title of the property in Barbados. It's a working plantation that still generates money from producing sugarcane. Drax inherited it a few years ago. He's effectively the owner. His most recent register of members' interests says he's administering the property and will take control of it in due course. Drax rarely comments on this history. In 2010, when he first stood for Parliament, he said, "I can't be held responsible for something that happened 300 or 400 years ago." He said it was an attempt to smear him. "They're using the old class thing," he said. "And that's not what this election is about. It's not what I stand for, and I ignore it." Drax spoke again for Paul and Jonathan's story. He said he was keenly aware of the slave trade in the West Indies and said the role of, quote, "my very distant ancestor" was deeply, deeply regrettable. He went on, "but no one can be held responsible today for what happened many hundreds of years ago. This is part of the nation's history, from which we must all learn." When she was a girl, playing near Drax Hall, Esther had no idea of its brutal past, nor who it still belonged to.
We just knew it was Drax Hall, but we did not know who owned it. There were white overseers who, and managers who lived there, or, you know, they were in charge, but we did not know who the owners were.
When did you find out for sure who the owners were?
Well, I don't have any legal documents or legal proof, but to the best of my knowledge, it is still in the Drax family.
Do you mind if I show you something? Just one second. Yeah. Esther, what I've got here,
mm-hmm.
You can grab that. It's not on this page, but this is a legal document.
Mm-hmm.
Which shows who actually owns this property. And if you go to the second page...
Who does? Richard... Richard Plunkett. That's Drax?
Yeah.
That's Drax. Those are the names. I recognize those names. Richard Plunkett, some kind of... Or something. Yeah, that's Drax.
So
So you do have a legal document showing they still own the property.
So that's proof that...
That's right.
This is still owned by Richard Drax.
That's right.
I mean, what do you make of that, to know that this property, where so much damage was done for generations, damage that you say continues to echo today, it's owned by somebody who sits in the British Parliament, is in fact one of the wealthiest landowners the British Parliament today.
Mm-hmm. It's part of that whole colonial burden that we still bear, where there's a sense of entitlement, you know, that these are people who feel that they have a right to it.
If you were in front of him right now, if you could talk to him, what would you say?
I would say to him, Mr. Drax, I'm not speaking from a position of hatred. To hate you would be to allow the system of slavery and all that power structure to win a second time. And I will not give you that privilege. I would like to say to you, Mr. Drax, that you need to listen to your conscience. To say that the past is behind you, it is not true. The blood of James and William Drax, that blood runs in your veins, which means that they are still with you. And the consequences of all that they have done, those consequences are with you as well. You are culpable. You are responsible. Because if the past is behind you, then the wealth should be put behind you as well. So if you are still benefiting from that wealth, you are just as culpable as those who accumulated the wealth. So you must listen to your conscience. You are in a position to help, so do something about it, Mr. Drax.
Colonialism has deep roots in Barbados. Slavery lasted for hundreds of years, and liberation is the project of centuries too. Emancipation was one step, independence another, and so too is becoming a republic today. But it's not the end. The Drax estate is just one way that the past still lives today. Cases like this one form the heart of a wider appeal by countries in the Caribbean and across the formerly colonized world, for countries in Europe that got rich through colonization to make reparations. That might mean funding development programs or forgiving debt. Caribbean countries are planning to step up the pressure in the years ahead, including the Republic of Barbados.
We're not begging for anything. We're saying that all that we're asking for has been paid for already with blood, sweat, tears, and free labor. Anything now that is given has already been earned.
That's it for today. If you want to read more of Michael Safi's reporting on this issue, do check out the article Nelson, BLM and New Voices, Why Barbados is Ditching the Queen. We've linked that on the Full Story page as well. This episode was produced by Joshua Kelly and Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers of Today in Focus are Archie Bland and Phil Maynard. Additional production by Karishma Luthria. We will be back with Full Story tomorrow.